Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I am Phil Taylor. I am here with Phil Conlon.
Good afternoon, Phil.
And today we're going to talk to Professor Harry Glasspeak. He is a professor emeritus and senior scholar at Osgoode Hall Law School, York University. He's written and taught corporate law. He's the author of Wealth by Stealth. We're going to be talking about this Lac-Megantic disaster, and the title of the piece by Harry Glasspeak is The Presumed Innocence of Capitalism, so we're going to find out about that. Now, I want to remind everybody, Tuesday, tomorrow, August the 6th, there is going to be the Hiroshima commemoration at City Hall. And Phil Conlon, you have a program tomorrow at 12, and you're going to be discussing this as well.
Well, yes, we are going to dedicate Classical Underground tomorrow to the commemoration of the horrific bombing of Hiroshima, August 6, 1945. Ted Schmidt, a veteran peace activist, author of Never Neutral, a recently published book of his memoirs, will be our guest. We'll be playing the music of Leonard Bernstein and a Japanese composer, Masao Oki, who wrote a long symphony inspired by some panels on Hiroshima, and we'll hear the poetry of Allen Ginsberg.
Good, thank you. By the way, I'll also remind our listeners, Phil Conlon is a veteran trade unionist, and you were in the railway worker.
I was a railway worker for 35 years.
So you're going to be very interested to know, too, what our guest, Professor Harry Glasspeak, has to say about this crisis. I believe we're joined now by Harry Glasspeak. Are you there?
I am indeed, Phil.
Hey, thank you very much for taking the time. You have published an article called The Presumed Innocence of Capitalism and Lac-Megantic. By the way, I'll tell our listeners, you can find that at socialistproject.ca/bullet and also at Climate and Capitalism, and that's Monthly Review Press. And I know everybody's very diligent and capable, and they will look this article up. Of course, now, you took the occasion of what happened at Lac-Megantic to point out some home truths about the capitalist system and how we are protected under it, or not, I guess, would be the way to put it.
Yeah.
Now, you listed, at the beginning of your article, you listed a bunch of very good questions that you say that everybody asks. Why was anyone allowed to engage in this activity, given its known risk? Why, more specifically, were people with poor reputations in respect of safety and people with little experience allowed to run these risky activities? Well, I'll ask you that question. What is the answer to that? I mean, let me give you a headline, by the way, or Harry, a quote from the guy who owns this railway, and he's quoted as a headline in the Globe, nobody knew what they were carrying. He said he didn't know what was in those cars. 72 cars parked on an incline with one engineer in the middle of the night. He said he didn't know, and he doesn't think anybody knew who was in the cars.
Well, he may well be speaking the truth, although you always have to take everything that people who are in the public eye on these occasions with a grain of salt. But he may well be speaking the truth, because the essence of what I tried to say in that article, and I do believe, of capitalist forms of production, is that people try to become wealthy, to accumulate wealth, and that wealth is generated by other people, you and the workers, they who combine it some way or another to produce that wealth. And the idea of accumulating that wealth is just the wealth. They don't care what they do in order to get it, and they don't care what anyone else does. That's the starting position, much as people deny it and they walk around the countryside talking about doing good and being socially responsible and caring about the environment or the workers. Their starting position is just simply that they want to accumulate wealth as much as possible. Their second position is that the best way to accumulate wealth, of course, is to produce goods or services more efficiently than anyone else, and therefore have a greater profit. Now, they can do that by out-competing their rivals, if any. They can do that by reducing wages, and they can, and they also always have a stake, therefore, in using technologies that replace workers who demand wages, and or to replace workers by going to other countries, if they can possibly do that. They do all of those things, but more importantly, they also want to avoid any kind of cost that they impose on the rest of it. In other words, they want things for free. They want free air. They want free water. They want free electricity. They want the free use of our environments. They want free uses of resources. If not free, as little cost or regulation as possible. So the whole notion is to find a way of what we call externalizing the risk. They want to put the risk on somebody else. And they've created a whole web of mechanisms, mostly legal mechanisms, I hasten to add as a lawyer, to help them in that way. So, for instance, they've created a corporation. And we always talk about corporations, but a corporation is just simply a device to collectivize workers and resources and to allow the people who own the corporation to hide behind the corporation. If anybody is responsible, it's the corporation, which is a legal thing. It's not a real thing, and it's not them. They pass the cost on to the corporation, and the corporation, in turn, will always do its best to pass it on to other people. But no, they are not to pay. And that's what happens in Lac Mégantic. You have a corporation. They have railroad running. That's how they make the money. They get a fee paid for whatever they carry. They don't give a damn what they carry. They don't get any if you can reduce costs by having one person at work instead of having two workers or four people, that's better. If you can do it by having an old railway set rather than a new one, then you use an old railway set. And if people try to push you around and can make you have more workers or have a better maintenance system, they will resist that for as long as they can. And so it's in that sense that these things happen.
Again, we're talking to Professor Harry Glasbeck, Professor Emeritus, Senior Scholar at Osgoode Hall Law School, written an awful lot about these matters. Of course, he's the author of the book, Wealth by Stealth.
Ah, you've been looking things up.
Well, it's an electronic age. Anybody can be a bright kid. Corporate crime, corporate law, and the perversion of democracy. Well, I guess we ought to talk about the perversion of democracy, because you just said we have laws.
Yes.
However, I think every pedestrian now is conversant with the fact that when they decide they're going to make a law about governing something, maybe, for example, checking on so-called fracking
yeah.
Oil, nobody, for example, puts in there, well, we want to know if you're using ingredients that might make this ordinary oil flammable. That you ask the company, and they give their best advice. And this touches on a point in your article, which is they are presumed to be virtuous, and they're trying to help.
Yeah.
But they didn't, on the answer to the question, did you put something in that oil that made it flammable? Well, it turns out they didn't have to tell you that.
So we
seem to have a kind of perverse democracy that prevents us from correct oversight. Could you enlarge on that?
Well, of course, I could try. Basically, what we do is we have put our faith, and it's really just a leap of faith. We put our faith in the fact that we've got to generate wealth so that we can all live at a reasonable level of welfare, and that means we have to use our resources and our talents and put them together in some way to produce things that we want, what we need, and in our society, unfortunately, also those that we want rather than need. But we've done that by leaving it to what we call the private sector, by which we just simply mean people who are doing it for profit. And we hope that they can do that better than we could do it as a collectivity, as a group of citizens put together. Now, those particular private actors will only do it if there's a buck in it. Otherwise, they don't do it for any other reason. And so when they, if they get enough bucks, which is what the problem is in our society, if you get enough people with enough money that they run things that we want them to run, we think of them as very important to us. We don't want them to take their bucks and go elsewhere. We don't want them to say, oh, we could invest better in Guatemala because the Guatemala government doesn't ask anything of us. You're asking us to put in, I don't know, a chimney to clean the environment. The Guatemalan government doesn't, so we go to Guatemala. So we are scared of them running away because we now rely on them. So we pretend that they're doing it for us while they're doing it for themselves, so we pretend they're virtuous, and that the activity of producing for profit is a virtuous activity when in fact it's a selfish activity. And by doing that, when we get around to regulating, when we say to them, well, look, you've gone too far this time, there are too many people getting hurt, or the environment is too despoiled, when they get to that point and we have to regulate, we don't have the knowledge. We're not the ones doing it. The government doesn't know anything. The public server doesn't know anything. I, as a citizen, don't know anything about fracking. So we have to ask them. Now, when we ask them, they've got two incentives. One is to tell us it's safe and they're lying. And the other one is to say to us, well, if you regulate us too much, we'll take our money and go to Guatemala. Mm-hmm. So we talk to them because they're virtuous, doing a virtuous activity, they're doing us a favor, and they have all the knowledge. We talk to them as if we were in a gentleman's club. We don't exercise our majoritarian power until it's too late. And that's why these things happen. So we're always compromising. I think in that article, I really can't remember because I'm an old man, but I think I have an example of how we set regulations. And the example I've always used is, if you get a man who puts his hand in a machine because he's working at it and he loses his fingers in the machine, we think that's, an accident. And if there are 10 people who lose their hands in that machine, we call it a cluster. And if a couple of hundred people lose their hand in the machine, we get a regulation. Then the regulator can say, oh, look, you've gone too far. We've got to put a guard on that machine. And that's how we regulate it. That's what happens at Lac-Mégantic. At Lac-Mégantic, we've had these railways. That train is obviously only running with one person carrying all sorts of cruddy stuff for ages and ages, right? Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden there is an accident, and we call it an accident, but it's bound to happen, of course. And then we say maybe we should have regulated, but it's too late. It's always too damn late.
Yes. Again, we're speaking to Professor Harry Glasspiegel, and this. By the way, I almost lost my hand in a punching machine once. I guess I wouldn't have been a cluster. I would have been unemployed.
Well, that's most often the case, of course, in most parts of the world.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting how quickly, almost as a cover, when they nearly kill everybody in a village, they killed 47, all of a sudden, overnight, well, I guess we should have more men on the crews.
Yeah.
And no, we shouldn't be parked on the main line, but rather on a siding, which you would have thought, we got old Phil here, I'll have to ask him about that, but why they would leave a car on the line where it could go to the next spot. But they do all these things to say, finish. But why isn't there a trial for those who had lied to us and said, we don't need more people on these trains? As a matter of fact, they were selling. I've been doing my homework on them. They were selling the idea that really they could do almost everything remote.
Yeah.
They didn't really need anybody on these trains. That really is just a part of a con, isn't it? I mean, now we're supposed to believe that they care about us again. And
and it happens each time. You made two very good points. I think one goes to their hands in the machine thing. It's always afterwards, right? We basically use the environment and human beings as the old canary in the coal mine. Mm-hmm. You send the canary down, the canary dies, maybe the workers shouldn't go down. Well, very often we just use the workers or the environment. You said 47 people have died, and that's awful, isn't it? But the amount of pollution left and the amount of harm that will be caused by that pollution is incalculable at the moment, but it will be great because this was filthy stuff in the water and in the air, and so there'll be more damage, and we will never calculate it. But when something like that happens, it's politically embarrassing. You see, when you get one where so 50 people are obviously destroyed, and it's a small village, and you can see it all there, it's a terrible tragedy. Everybody genuinely feels sorry and feels bad. They say we mustn't let that happen again. Mm-hmm. But for instance, if the train had crashed exactly the same way and it crushed one child at the end of the road and nothing else had happened, it would have been a sad accident, but there would have been no new regulations.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't have talked about it. So we really just put a price on the regulation, which is the cost to human beings and the cost to the environment. It's got to be extreme. It's got to be extreme before we take any kind of strong stance. And so we can regulate, we do regulate, but it's always after the fact. It's very rarely effective in to prevent anything. Mm-hmm. It's merely prevent. It's a bit like, you know, this may be offbeat for you, but it's a bit like 9/11, right? You get 9/11, some people steal planes, they fly them into a tower, everybody is, it's a tragedy, everybody rails around. What do we do next? Well, we now check airports.
Yes.
Right. We have
a barn door law. If something bad happens, close the barn door.
Right. That's it.
Only one, by the way, not in the neighboring industry, which a disaster is looming.
Yeah.
But in the one that happened.
Exactly.
you elaborate on this cost benefit analyses, which you say it's just kind of like a bookkeeping issue with them. First they tell you you must have this. Your oil is your lifeblood, and you we're the wonderful people who see to it that you have cheap oil, etc. So you always want to weigh that against any complaints you might have about our killing you.
Yeah. No, that's exactly. And we do have lots of statements in our theoretical books. They're quite chilling. I've got one from a very, very important judge in the United States, a man called Posner. He's likely to be appointed to the Supreme Court of the United States at some stage of his life, I'd say. He was a famous academic before he became a judge. And he actually writes, in all seriousness, he said, only a fool would not weigh human life against profits. Sometimes you just have to give up human life, but although human life is very important, so you've got to give it a good deal of weight. and that's for, I think, for most of us sitting in our families and sitting at home or going to our picnics, that's just an absolutely repulsive idea. But that is the kind of decision made every day. And you can do that in many ways, Phil. If you look at a car, a car is made, and it's made of various substances with various powers and capacities, and we know that drivers make mistakes. So we know all these things when we do them, and they're all planned. And then we put them on the road, and then they blow up, or the brakes don't work, or the cruise control doesn't come off, or any number of things, right? Accidents happen, people get hurt and die. What do the manufacturers always say? Well, if you want more safety, you're going to have to pay more.
Mm-hmm.
You see, that's the response.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't, it's interesting how they aren't part of us.
No, absolutely not.
That when the reasoning begins, they're sort of the remote magical creatures that Ayn Rand imagines. I mean, that is, they say, well, I'll fold my arms and you won't get anything if you demand a bunch of safety things.
Yes.
I'll take my business elsewhere. Actually, we have a man, I mean, this the villain, or one of them in this story, of course, is the man for the railway company who, he said this Quebec asked him to pay for the cleanup. I shouldn't say they asked. They said, you're going to pay. And he said, well, my insurance says they won't cover it, so I'm not doing anything. You know, if we were ordinary, you and I, talking back to someone, and we had an accident where we destroyed their home or whatnot, such conversation wouldn't be so pleasant for us. We'd be probably talking through bars while they discussed what we were going to do.
Yeah. No, you're picking up on one of the great contradictions, right? There is a dam in us, and most people are treated very differently from large investors. Remember what I said. They start off, we believe they're virtuous actors, so if something goes wrong, it's not the virtuous activity that's an issue. It is perhaps this particular guy might be a bad apple in this beautiful barrel.
Oh, like right? The policeman.
Yeah,
yes.
That sort of thing. And it might be just that. So they start off from that proposition. So what you have is always the different set of rules. And you're quite right. If I don't pay my debts, all sorts of things will happen to me if I don't pay up for what I owe. Whereas what this guy is actually saying, and it takes a number of eddying downward steps. He is not speaking for himself. He doesn't know anything. Mm-hmm. Remember, he is merely a chairman and executive of this corporation. He doesn't know anything. It's not his. It's the corporation which is on the hook. And he's saying, I'm acting for this corporation. My legal responsibility is to act in the best interest of that corporation. And the best interest of that corporation, of course, is not to pay anything if I can avoid it. Now, of course, my corporation is insured for this. And so, therefore, I have to clear my insurance whether I will pay it. If my insurance won't pay for it, my corporation may or may not have the assets to pay for it. So I've got to check that out. Mm-hmm. So I'm waiting. So it is outrageous. But remember, it's made more difficult. When he's speaking, I think, from Illinois, isn't he?
Yes.
Isn't that where he is?
Well, so he kind of moves around like a lot of these people.
Yeah.
He's in Illinois, I think.
And the corporation, which is insured and probably paid the premiums in Illinois, and the people who are in Quebec, they have their offices in Quebec, probably have no coverage at all. They're just mm-hmm. operators. And I don't know that, but that'd be my guess. So that you get a difficulty about finding the person to pay. You could charge the corporation in Quebec, but they won't have any money. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, we don't have any money, and the best thing you could do is wait for the parent corporation to pay.
And we're in Illinois if you want us.
And they're insured in Illinois, and their insurance company is probably in England. And
yes.
So
we never hear about Lloyd's anymore. It used to be a magical name, Lloyd's, would float in when we had a disaster.
Yes.
Lloyd's will take... they went under or something.
Yeah, well, they did go under for a while, and then they're resurrecting them. They now own some other bank that went under. And But none of them suffer. You see, that's the important thing to remember. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but so it is true that they don't pay in the same way. It's the same thing with... there may be some prosecutions in this case in due course. There are laws under which they can be prosecuted, of course, for having done the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. And that will take quite a while.
Well, they did their best, by the way, in the first 48 hours to see if they could convict their own employee.
Yes. Oh, no. They immediately blame the worker, right? That's always the first response. I don't know whether you watch the same television as I do, but I'm staggered by the number of people when there is an airline crash or something of that nature, or a ferry boat goes under, they say, oh, the pilot was drunk or he was asleep at the wheel. That's the first reaction, of course.
Yes. this is Professor Harry Glasbeck, and the article is published in two places to me. Where I lost my notice where that is. Oh, no, it's socialistproject.ca/bullet and Climate and Capitalism. That's Monthly Review Press. And Harry, you have a very nice point in one of your paragraphs here where you say that when they have agreements about guaranteeing safety, et cetera, some of the actual agreement itself, the specifics, is often secret.
And
in other words, I wouldn't be able to check if I said, gee, I don't know, why are you supposed to have that car on a main line there? They would say, well, you know, look at the regulations, but I wouldn't be able to see it.
Not immediately. There's some.
I'd have to hire you to find out.
It happens. I got this information from the Toronto Star, in fact, because I'm not close to this particular event, of course, but the Toronto Star reported that Transport Canada when it was setting its regulations about how locomotives should be dealt with when at rest, apparently came to a deal with the operators as to that there should be sufficient brake power applied. But sufficient, of course, is a rather vague word.
Yes. So what is that?
Yeah. So that will be the issue in any kind of legal proceedings that will follow up here, I think. But in the meanwhile, of course, they had to the operator said, well, what the hell does sufficient mean? And then they argued about sufficient, and they did that in private. So what is in fact a regulation for public safety was privately set, and according to the Star. The Star tried to find it and was not available to it.
That's a classic way to disempower us, right?
Yes. I mean, unless
we have a Superman like Ralph Nader who flies through the clouds and lands and insists and fights and argues, But I mean, but we are disempowered. They look at us like it's none of your business.
Well, you've got to, again, it's the trust thing. The argument is again a leap of faith. We elect government. Governments appoint regulators. The regulators are supposed to be neutral and looking after our safety and the welfare of the virtuous activity. They deal with the virtuous actors. Right? All of these are assumptions. Right? Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, you get a regulation which reflects what the last accident looked like, and to prevent that particular thing happening again.
Mm-hmm.
And so you finish up with that. So even when it's published, what you have is almost no accountability all along the way, because you don't know how the regulation is being enforced. And the typical example, the best that your listeners will know about, was the famous or infamous Westray explosion, which is just like Lac-Mégantic, by the way, and where the mine exploded. And by the time they exploded, there were in fact Nova Scotia coal mine regulations were in existence, and there had been 52 noted and recorded violations by the time that the mine exploded. Of those 52, the inspectors and the coal mine regulation had done their job. They'd gone down there, looked, and said, oh, you shouldn't be using this, you shouldn't be doing that, you should put more scaffolding over there, there should be more measurement of the methane over here. They did all the things that the coal mine regulations required, but not once did they try to enforce any of them. It is sort of like, it's like parking in the wrong spot day after day and being told by the parking attendant that you're parked in the wrong spot. And the...
We'd all love that, wouldn't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, wouldn't we? and so
that's an inducement to break the rules.
Even if it's transparent, even if we know the regulation, that doesn't mean that they will actually be policed.
Yeah, I noticed, by the way, it says in an article I found at Toronto Star Saturday, August the 3rd, U.S. train inspection data showed nearly 5,000 breaches of securement regulations since January 2009.
Right. And so they know about the breaches. And
no wrist,
and,
no slap.
And done virtually nothing about them. Today, for instance, there was another derailment in Louisiana, and with chemicals leaking all over the place, and they had to evacuate a couple of hundred houses, I think. And it is quite common.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing. And I think what I do say in the article, and it's a bit complex to explain on the radio, but it's. Really, when you set a regulation, what a virtuous actor, a capitalist, really does, when he sets up a business, he plans his business. He says what he will produce, how he intends to produce it, what mechanisms, what technology he's going to use, what kind of skilled workers he wants, how many workers, how long he will retain his investment in a particular place. That's called business planning, right? And he makes all those decisions. The government makes none of those. Right, and that is, we are not participants in any of that. So when mm-hmm. we come to them and say, well, look, you've got to look after, there's a water table here, you mustn't pollute that, or mm-hmm. the workers must not work more than 8 hours a day, or whatever we come along and say to them, they say, yes, but let's bargain about that. Let's bargain,
yes.
Otherwise we won't invest.
Mm-hmm.
So they bargain about the likely cost. They try to calculate the cost of the water being polluted, of workers being too tired and becoming stressed or whatever, right? They bargain about that. So what they're doing is they're putting a price on the cost. And the mm-hmm. result, the regulatory result, is actually a prediction that there will be X amount of pollution, there will be Y amount of accidents, and so on, so that there is nothing accidental about them. They're actually planned into the system.
Yes.
And it's only when you get a Lac-Mégantic that you see that, because it's such a horrible result.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually a planned series of harms that we have.
By the way, you have a wonderful quote from one of the most romantic leaders of the capitalist movement. Almost his name almost embodies it, John D. Rockefeller. And the quote is, "The American beauty rose can be produced in the splendor and fragrance which bring cheer to its beholder only by sacrificing the early buds which grow up around it. This is not an evil tendency in business. It is merely the working out of a law of nature and a law of God."
That's pretty good, isn't it?
the self-love in that, you call him a social Darwin, but the romanticism of the, you know, that I'm just God's agent.
Mm. No, And what he's saying, of course, is very much the idea that you can't produce goods and services without doing some harm to the producers in your environment. And there's nothing harmful about it. And notice that what he's really saying is, I'm virtuous. I'm producing a good and service. And so we hurt a few people. That's the law of God in nature. So it is.
Yes, you can't.
And it's, of course, it is. And it's not, if you substitute the word capitalism for nature and God, you've got the whole thing.
Again, it's Professor Harry Glasspiegel. In winding up, Harry, I want to make sure I mention that two cultural figures that over the years have commented about this. Recently, Roseanne Barr, who really is a very sharp commentator, mm-hmm. and she's doing her best to fight the capitalists. She supported the 99 against the one.
Yeah.
She said that, well, if a corporation is a person, then inflict capital punishment on it.
Yeah.
She said, if it is a person. But then also, you know, we have this great popular song, Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land.
Yeah.
Now, I'm thinking about that. The train started. They load it up in North Dakota with all this stuff, and it passes into Canada, through Canada, down through Montreal, and sadly Lac-Mégantic, and then it was to go on to Maine, and then up again to New Brunswick. And so, you know, when Guthrie wrote the song, his point was that it actually isn't. He wrote it because he wasn't allowed to cross property. He kept seeing signs that said, no trespassing.
Yeah.
Shouldn't we have a quarrel about whose land this is? I mean, look at that train. These guys make all this money,
yeah.
and then tell us to get off the blasted train, or they'll hit us with a stick. All of our best ports got hit with a stick trying to ride a train. But yeah. I mean, whose track and all that? I mean, who gave them that? And how do we get it back?
Well, how do we get it back is the big question. For capital, literally, these days, there are no borders. I'll just leave you with that thought. The essence of all the free trade agreements that we've entered into so far is that the government of I'm an old man, I'm forgetting the name, who was Trudeau's one of my favorite guys of all time, Jean Chrétien.
Yeah, Jean Chrétien.
His free trade agreement, he said, I'm not having a free trade agreement unless we have protection for the environment or the workers in it. And so they put a side agreement to NAFTA. And the side agreement says that that workers can bring actions if the domestic law in Mexico, Canada, or the United States is breached. But they must ask permission to bring the action in the nation in which they are, and then a tribunal will be appointed and decide whether the domestic law was breached in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And finance capital is not subject to those rules.
Mm.
It can have the rules applied not of the domestic jurisdiction, but of the jurisdiction they choose, and they can implement that directly. They have to ask no one's permission to bring the action. And that's what you see in the train movement. They do not have to ask permission because we grant it to them willingly. We want them to come to our country and endanger us. Now, to be fair, there is a reliance on them. The leap of faith is such that, like Mégantic people, actually probably want the railway to run through their township because it brings them some money,
mm-hmm.
which they need for the village.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sadness. That's the same thing with the Westray. People wanted the coal mine, even though it was known to be dangerous,
mm-hmm.
because they need the work. We are dependent on these people we call virtuous actors, and then they behave like the devil, yeah. and then we're stuck.
Okay, but we're not stuck with the devil, right? We could do something.
I hope
but
so.
Once you've said it, I think that the cat's out of the bag, so we'll have to do something. But Harry Glasspiegel, we're very grateful. You clarified a lot of matters. The presumed innocence of capitalism and Lac-Mégantic. And Harry's also the author of Wealth by Stealth, Corporate Crime, Corporate Law, and the Perversion of Democracy, a great subtitle. This article you can find at socialistproject.ca/bullet and also at Climate and Capitalism Monthly Review Press. Harry, thanks an awful lot. We appreciate it.
Absolute pleasure.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Harry Glasspiegel. Now, Phil, did you learn anything? You were in the railroad man.
No, it's I learned all that. Harry described exactly the way it works. there is one thing I want to comment on. When the boss says, we have no idea what's in that train, of course, he globally speaking, ideologically speaking, of course, he's right. He doesn't care. As long as somebody pays him to carry freight, he doesn't care what it is. But in fact, and one of the things I worked on at the railroad for years was properly classifying freight. There was a time before deregulation when you had to be extremely particular about what was in a rail car, and the idea that somebody would have loaded it up with crude oil and have put flammable additives in it, frankly, in the 1970s, I don't think that would have gone on. So we've actually gotten worse.
By the way, now, that raises the question, would you know the answer? Perhaps NAFTA had something to do with that.
Well, I would think it's actually... Even before NAFTA, you had this issue of deregulating the railways in North America in all kinds of ways, and pulling back on government inspections and government auditing of the operations of railways was a big push. Don't forget, a lot of the railways complained they weren't making very very much money. They were going bankrupt, or the shareholders weren't getting sufficient return. And the solution to this was to get rid of government regulators, and then to get rid of union contracts or strip them down.
But incidentally, we're in a culture where if like Fox News, CNN, anybody, CBC mentions the union, they're immediately, that's a pejorative. That's a narrow interest group. As opposed to the boss.
You know, we could operate this train much more efficiently and safely, but the union rules get in the way.
We were trying to spread the wealth, but these guys, they're very greedy. We'll get their pensions someday for that. You're listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And with Carol, we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.